This holiday, BMW has reunited three members of the family at the BMW Road Home Sales Event. The Agile X3, engineered for any adventure. The plug-in hybrid X5, commanding the streets with unmatched presence. And the all-electric i4, charging into the future with impeccable performance. Hurry in to find what powers your journey at the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through January 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
All right, back on the Jeff Calkins Show. Let's do this Chris Harrington deal. Chris Harrington joins me now. Chris, what are we listening to?
That is Ball and Chain by Big Mama Thornton, who did record More Than Hound Dog, born on this day in 1924.
So when we last spoke to you, you were heading out to a birthday dinner at an indigenous restaurant, I guess. And everything on the menu was here before the white man arrived. All the ingredients. So no beef, no pork, bison, elk, corn. How was it?
It was very good. I probably will, because it actually wasn't that expensive. I'll probably order a little bit differently next time. They were out of the duck, which I probably would have gotten. We probably would have gotten everything was shareable. But in the absence of that, we were more interested in, you know, the more, you know, non-meat stuff on the menu, trying to explore that and be able to try different stuff. But you ended up with a lot of similar kind of flavors and textures, you know, a lot of sweet potato, a lot of squash, a lot of corn, a lot of berries.
Right.
So I probably would have, and if I'd done it over again, thrown some elk in there just to mix it up a little bit. But it was very good. Maple chili crisp sweet potatoes, roasted squash with mole and chimichurri, and this really interesting dish I'd never heard of called sotki, which is a kind of almost like a corn, it was a blue corn sort of porridge with maple and berries. It was all very good.
What was dessert?
It was a berry cobbler, which was interesting because, you know, there's no butter, there's no flour.
The ice cream
is, it's not ice cream, it was a squash sorbet on top. And so it's a very earthy, like a really intense berry kind of flavor to it, you know. And obviously the berries are all, you know, there's no, you know, no preservatives or anything going
on there
either. It's all very natural.
No flour, no butter. Incredible.
Yep.
All right. So Grizzlies don't play until Friday, so we have some time to mull some things over, including the, I want to have some more questions from your mailbag, some of which we briefly addressed yesterday. But the Athletic did a top 10 front offices in the NBA. 40 executives and coaches voted, and the Grizzlies are number 4 behind Oklahoma City, 1, Boston, 2, Miami, 3, and the Grizzlies, 4. I do recall, I forgot what the survey was this summer. Maybe it was the Future Survey or something where the, you know, they totaled up a bunch of different categories, and one of them was front office. And I think that was ESPN, not The Athletic. And it was funny because because of the injuries last year, all of a sudden the front office had gone from basically the equivalent of 4th to 12th or something like that. Now, here it is. But anyway, what do you make of the Grizzlies' front office being ranked 4?
That's a high ranking, but a fair ranking. I think they've done a great job. I think it's sort of, it's a high ranking because objectively 4 out of 30 is high, but also because it's hard to get higher than that. I think OKC and Boston have been so good,
right?
You know, it's sort of hard to pierce up all the way up there. And Miami of late, I don't know, but I mean they have such a strong reputation over a long period of time now with the same guys, you know. So I think it's sort of hard to get higher than 4. But like this organization has done a great job, and it's the kind of thing I think it's good. We tend to focus on mistakes, but like everybody makes mistakes. And at this point, every front office that's been around for any period of time has lots of mistakes. You can literally do a top 10 mistakes of this front office list and still say they're the 4th best front office in the NBA. That's just the way it goes, right? And so fans tend to focus on like, you know, was not picking up Jake LaRavia's option a mistake? Probably so. Was, you know, Zaire Williams pick a mistake? Yeah. And like there's a long list of them, and yet still, when you add it all together, like they may be the fourth best front office in the league. You know, they've done a great job.
It's unbelievable, really, because normally the ratio of mistakes to hits, even for successful, is wildly weighted towards mistakes. The fact that you can rattle off hit after hit after hit after hit after hit, particularly obviously in the draft, but not exclusively in the draft, obviously free agency signings would be another one. It's really kind of extraordinary what they've done. And it also, by the way, I said this earlier, it was for Robert Pera to elevate Zach Kleiman was a hell of a risk. I mean, I don't know, anyone's a risk. I guess you hire someone, but he's a 29-year-old lawyer that who had been brought in by Jason Levien at age 29 to run the place. I give him more credit for not doing the obvious thing, you know?
Yeah, I mean, Pera has to make these decisions ultimately. I really think that, and I'm not privy to everything, but my sense is that it's really Jason Wexler, and then a guy we've sort of forgotten about, Joe Abadi, who I think may still be Pera's lawyer.
Yep.
I think they sort of cultivated Kleiman, you know? And, like, I remember when, I haven't talked to Joe Abadi in a long time, but when they hired Zach Kleiman, Joe reached out to me and said, this guy's great. This guy's going to do great. And Joe had sort of been out of the mix, and, like, I didn't know if, you know, and so, like, I was sort of surprised by that, right? And I really think, like, you know, they sort of cultivated, they went out and hired Kleiman. He was a lawyer for a firm in New York that was representing the NBA, and that's where they found him, business with him. And they brought him into sort of a, you know, team council kind of position and really cultivated him over the course of a few years and worked him up. And he's just done a great job. And he's done a great job in a way that it's not just about him. You know, he's built this good staff. You know, we talked about Tayshaun Prince, who was already there, and Rich Cho and Chris Makris and different people who have different strengths. And, like, it's really a really well-functioning organization.
And I do think you also have to give credit to Pera for building it. Like, Pera, some people are unhappy. No one's really unhappy that he's never here. I don't think anyone gives a damn, honestly.
I don't think people care anymore.
I don't think anyone cares. But the truth of the matter is, he's been great on two fronts. One is, this is just true, that when they had the lease, you know, they had to redo the lease 5 years ago or whenever it was because the early escape clause had been triggered. I do believe that if the other owners, had gotten a hold of this, they would have used the early escape clause to get the hell out of Dodge. And Pera never had any inclination of doing that, and is never. Who knows? We don't know what the future will hold. But really, at a time when there have been opportunities, has never shown any slightest inclination to take advantage of that so far. And I give him enormous credit for that. And then he's built an organization that in a small market, I mean, hell, look at the mess that New Orleans is, just by contrast, right? It's really done a hell of a job over there.
It is hard. I mean, look around other, Charlotte, look at Detroit, look at Sacramento. These are other, like all those markets are bigger than Memphis, but they're in the bottom half of, like, you know, whether it's market size or market glamour or market whatever. Like, these are places that have been bad to mediocre, like, forever, you know?
Yep.
It's really hard to do what they've done.
And they obviously lucked into Ja Morant, but you know what? New Orleans lucked into Anthony Davis, and they lucked into Chris Paul, and they lucked into Zion Williamson, and, you know, whatever. So, but just to tease this out a little bit, I'm not saying you should do top 10 mistakes, but what have been their biggest mistakes?
Feel bad because people overemphasize that.
Nothing glaring, honestly. The Justice Rooms
are great.
There's
no team to beat draft pick. There's no Chandler Parsons signing, right? Like Justice Winslow with a swing and the miss. Guess what? They gave up not much to get him. Like, mostly they gave up money.
Yep. And that all resolved itself. Yep.
They gave up opportunity cost in terms of, like, you know, money they swallowed to make that happen. The Zion Williams pick was bad, but that was a really complicated trade. I've heard people say, Like, John Hollinger, Nate Duncan was doing an organization rankings podcast recently, And John had the Grizzlies a little bit higher than Nate, but they both had them, like, I don't know, like, lower than this, right? You know, 8, 9, 10, something like that, whatever. And Nate was going back to that and saying, well, you know, and everyone thought that, you know, they were really downgrading at center. And I was talking back to my pod saying, yeah, but they didn't think that. You know,
right.
It doesn't matter what everyone else thought. They didn't think that. They didn't see it as we're downgrading from Jonas to Steven Adams in order to take a swing on Zaire Williams. They preferred Steven Adams.
Right. Yeah. No, it's been astonishing. And the level of hits in the draft is just crazy. And then to find another one in Jalen Wells. It's just, it's absolutely remarkable what they've done. It is an interesting list because I think you're right. You can't do better. Oklahoma City, you know, legendary, particularly the Paul George deal is crazy. And then Boston has added player after player, has traded. They didn't break up the core, and then they go out and they get Derek White, they get Porzingis, they get Drew Holiday. I mean, that's just a masterclass. Miami, for all the historical reasons. It is interesting, two of the others that rank highest is Minnesota at 5 and the Knicks at 6. Who, of course, made the deal with each other. What do you make of those two?
It's interesting. I think they call this front office rankings, right? Is that how they label it?
They call it front office rankings, yes. Top 10.
Yeah, but then they list, like, the governor, which is, like, the main controlling owner, basically, the GM or whatever, and then the coach, right? So that's broader organization, right?
Yep.
Minnesota, I think you got to factor in the ownership situation. So, like, how are they that high? I understand Tim Connelly is well respected, but come on.
Because the owner is it? Do they include owners here? Let me just make sure. I'm not.
If you open it up and look, because I looked at it this morning. If you look at it, they list the governor. The three people they list are the governor, which means
it's the owner. Right, it's the new word for owner.
Yeah,
right.
The lead front office executive and the head coach. So that's a totality of organization.
Well, and honestly, James Dolan's no picnic either. You know, he'll spend money, but he's no picnic either. In terms of what they've done, though, those are, okay, below the governor level, those are two front offices that were for many years.
The Knicks have done a great job. It's interesting. Those are teams that just made this big trade with each other, and people are not quite sure about this. It seems to be working out better for the Knicks right now than the Wolves. But, you know, the Gobert thing was a trade that was highly criticized. You know, it took a couple of years, and they got to the conference finals with it. I mean, the Knicks clearly, you could wonder about, did they give up too much for Mikal Bridges? Is some of this stuff going to work? But relative to what the Knicks had been for 20 years before this front office got clicking, it's a totally different thing.
Right. After that, it is you got Orlando at 7. You've got Cleveland at 8, which seems a little low. I don't really understand why Cleveland would be, like, if you're giving the Grizzlies credit, why wouldn't Cleveland? They make the Donovan Mitchell trade and they get him to sign the extension. They make it work there. It is interesting. Oh, there's San Antonio. I was going to say, once upon a time, San Antonio would have been in everybody's top 5, right? For years and years and years.
They're still coasting on Tim Duncan, man. Even now.
I think they're still coasted on Tim Duncan, even now. All right. Other matters. Well, I asked you this question yesterday, and then I interrupted you, and I diverted us to talking about Cam Johnson. But the question over at the mailbag, which I've tweeted out, was most likely to be traded. So what Grizzly most likely to be traded by the trade deadline?
I feel like, all things considered, the guys you have to put at the top of that list are Luke Kennard, who is, I think, lower in the rotation, you know, with the emergence of Jalen Wells, and is not under contract next season, so that's a $9 million expiring, very easy to move. And then John Conchar, who is, like, you know, out of the rotation, and that is a contract that can help you match salaries. They don't have a lot of contracts that are, like, you know, less than, you know, 10 and more than 2 or 3, right? So that's $6 million. So I think those are the two most likely. If you're talking about bigger deals, then, like, Marcus Smart is the obvious guy there. And then you got the questions about LaRavia and Aldama because they're headed to free agency. But I doubt they're going to move. They would move Aldama. And LaRavia, who knows? You know, it would be more a matter of whether his contract fits to make a deal work, you know? Those five guys are sort of the guys.
The LaRavia, Aldama, and you addressed this a little bit, they're both some version of free agents this summer, but they're in very different situations because the Grizzlies have the right to match with Aldama, whereas Jake, they're actually encumbered with how much they can offer, right? There's a limit to how much they can. Here's my question.
They can't offer Laravia contract bigger than the contract they already declined, which was 1 year, I think, $5.1 million.
So does Jake Laravia, though, an acquiring team would have that same constraint, and so does he have any particular value? Like, you diminished, again, I'm not, we think it's a great front office, this may have been a mistake, they diminished the value to you, but also to a acquiring team. Why would a team, unless another team wants him for the stretch run, why would another team give anything particular for Jake Laravia?
Well, I don't think Jake Laravia is going to be the centerpiece of some major trade. Right. I think it could be like, you get a second-round pick or two, and it's for a team that thinks they're going to help him down the stretch. Of course, maybe he's helping the Grizzlies down the stretch. I'm not enthusiastic about that kind of trade this season.
Right.
Or maybe it's you're trying to match salaries in some deal that involves more players, and that's one of the salaries that, like, I'll throw out an example, like the Cam Johnson thing, right, which we talked about. Like, Marcus Smart and Jake Laravia for Cam Johnson is an exact salary match within, like, a couple hundred thousand. So, like, if you're trying to trade for Cam Johnson, maybe it's that, and then you're adding the draft picks for value,
And, I mean, you'd be talking multiple draft picks, right?
That would be my guess. Yeah, a couple first-rounders with that.
In terms of what they – and you make clear, I heard you talking to Jeffrey when I was away, the chances of anything happening, always less likely than nothing happening, because nothing is easier and simpler. But if and all of this remains to still be evaluated, particularly Marcus Smart's role, what's going to like when Zay Akiti comes back, what's going to look like, whether we have much, whether Gigi and Vince will come back in time to get much more information before the trade deadline remains to be seen. But right now, what is the type of player the Grizzlies would be interested in, you imagine, in a theoretical deal?
Well, I imagine part there is key. I mean, I can't speak for the front office. They may not share my assessment. But my assessment is a big wing, a wing player, someone in that 2-3-4 area with size and experience, right? They got guys in that area with experience, like Marcus Smart, who does not have size, or Luke Kennard with experience and does not have size. And they don't really have much size, but like, let's say Gigi comes back, Gigi Jackson, Jake Laravia, they've got pretty good size. They don't have experience. You don't have someone who's like the 6'7", 6'8", wing player who can knock down shots and has played playoff basketball. Like, that does not exist on this roster. And I think that is a highly useful kind of player. And so that's where, like, the Cam Johnson comes in, Dorian Finney-Smith comes in. You know, we'll see Drew on our podcast yesterday brought up Herb Jones because New Orleans is sort of imploding. And does he become available? Those kind of players, I think, I would assume the Grizzlies would have some interest in.
One team that's accumulated several of that ilk, Oklahoma City, beat Dallas last night rather handily. Luca, afterwards, you were eating berries and root vegetables, and so you may not have seen much of it. But
I was grazing, yes.
Yes, that's a... that's a hell of an Oklahoma City team. Like,
Chet Holmgren's not playing right now. He's probably their second best player. So they're really good.
They're really good. Thank you, Chris. Appreciate it.
Thanks,
Chris Harrington from the Daily Memphian. If you are looking to get something framed, let's say you've got some sports memorabilia, and you want to, instead of having it, over in the corner or a pile somewhere on a shelf or whatever, go ahead and get it framed. Have it custom framed. And the place to go is the Frame Corner, 5035 Park Avenue. I told you earlier this year, there was someone from Jonesboro who had his grandfather's or father's Arrowhead collection. Well, who can possibly frame that? Like, I can put a picture in a frame myself, but I couldn't begin to know how to do the Arrowhead collection. So he brought it in all the way from Jonesboro because he knew about the expert custom framing at the Frame Corner and was thrilled with the results. So whether you have a collection of photos or whether you have some memorabilia or anything else, thoughtful, very thoughtful as a gift, by the way, head on into the Frame Corner, 5035 Park Avenue, framecornermemphis.com. Back in a moment with Sam Hardiman. We have a lot to discuss. It is a busy day. It's the Jeff Calkins Show, 92.9 FM ESPN. All right, back on the Jeff Calkins Show, joined now by Sam Hardiman. Sam Hardiman of the Daily Memphian. You can read him over at the Daily Memphian on Twitter or X at Sam Hardiman. It has been a busy stretch for Sam. We even had to skip a week. Sam has been so busy with reporting on the events of the city. Before I get to any of that, Sam, I know that your dad is a Yankees fan. And I know that as a Yankees fan, he even went to a World Series game. Didn't turn out the way he would have wanted. But I'm wondering how your dad, the Yankees fan, is dealing with the news of Juan Soto jumping from the Yankees to, I can only presume, the hated Mets.
I would say we spoke about it this morning. We kind of finally debriefed on that in the Max Fried news. And I would say, like, as a retired finance professor, he understands, like, maybe the long-term liability. Avoiding that is pretty good. I think he's a little sad about the opportunity cost of what the Yankees gave up in the trade to get Juan Soto. And, you know, what they gave to the Padres, particularly Rhode Islander, Michael King. I want to emphasize that Michael King is from Rhode Island. Very good pitcher for the Padres. And, yeah,
he's not upset. He's not upset. How about, is he more?
No.
The risk of Max Fried, who's got had all kind of health issues, a 8-year deal for a 30-year-old pitcher with health issues, that would be more problematic for your father.
Yeah, he's not wild about that. He still is complaining about Carlos Rodon's contract from a few years ago. He's not a big fan of the Giancarlo Stanton deal. So, like, that's what is really on his brain as a Yankee fan right now. Not necessarily Juan Soto. I think he has, like, just – he's awed, like, a lot of people at the money that Steve Cohen is willing to spend over in Flushing.
Well, that's the other thing. Like, it's not like – in baseball, there's no cap. So you don't have to – the fact that you make a mistake on a contract, if you make a mistake on a contract, as long as you have an owner willing to burn money, who cares, right? It doesn't particularly matter like it does in the NHL, the NFL. It can become disabling to have a bad deal.
Right. I mean, yeah, just bearing luxury tax payments. Like, as long as your owner is willing to bear the luxury tax payments, they can do whatever. Yeah.
And then, secondly, another sports story we've been following with you, your Patriots, in the news because Bill Belichick might be going to UNC and because Drake May continues to play well. So what do you think of Belichick to UNC, and are you now persuaded that you have the quarterback of the future?
I want to probably acknowledge at this point that I was skeptical of Drake May, and I was skeptical of just drafting a quarterback high in the first round.
I remember that.
I was skeptical, and I was wrong, and I want that to be clear. I atone for that. Bill Belichick to UNC, the whole Bill Belichick arc to me right now is just weird. Like, it's been a little weird since he left the Patriots, and this is also kind of weird. I don't think he's going to go to UNC. I could be wrong. We just acknowledge how wrong I was about Drake May. But, like, is he just leaking this for kind of some attention? That's just what I've been reading into it. I have no reporting here. It's just Sam, who's very busy with news, kind of following.
Okay. Thus ends the sports portion of this conversation, because we're not going to talk about my Sabres who've lost 7 straight. So when we last we're going to talk to you, we couldn't because you were about to break some news about you and Sophia, about XAI. We learned last week that there is going to be even more super. What was the news?
Yeah, the news, and shout out to my colleague Sophia Surratt, and I. We published a story, and then everyone published it shortly thereafter, that XAI is going to grow to a million chips. So this supercomputer right now has 200,000 chips, which is giant, and is running essentially a large language model that powers Grok. If you want to go play with Grok on the internet, that's what's powering is the supercomputer down in Memphis, and likely a lot of AI applications for Musk-related firms, or some. From Musk-related firms. And so that's the news. And it's certainly significant. I mean, if you do the math, it's likely tens of billions of dollars being poured into Memphis in terms of personal property value, not a tremendous amount of jobs. It's probably only going to be in the low hundreds of jobs, this total thing, over time. But it's a lot of...
Why does it matter if there's a 10 times the value of chips in Memphis as opposed to previously, if there's not jobs attached to them? And I got to get to the jobs that may be coming, whatever. Does that have any intrinsic value to the city of Memphis or the region?
to both Memphis and Shelby County, it's a tremendous amount of potential property tax revenue, right?
I see. Yeah.
It's a very high, like, density value per acreage of property tax revenue. It'll be probably some of the most valuable, it will obviously depreciate. Personal property depreciates over time, right? And the trips won't be 100% of their worth or taxed at it for any length of time. But essentially what you're talking about is just some very, very valuable technology. Because XAI chose not to get tax incentives upon moving here, right? It chose not to do that. The company did. They'll be pulling full freight taxes, okay? I mean, for context, there are some very large businesses in this community that don't pay full freight on very valuable equipment in this community, right? And they have tax incentives. So that's the real value here. The value is taxes, and that's really boring. But in
no,
a
but
city
tax
where,
income is not that boring. It seems critical. Yeah. Is the fear, of course, is that people have, the concern that is always raised is environmental issues and power issues. And I gather, I mean, you wrote a story following this addressing the power supply. What do we know about that, or how confident are we that the power demands will be met and met in a way that does not negatively impact the other people in the community?
This is the real kicker here for this announcement, and like is not like a, it's a headwind that it has to like fight. Is simply, if this thing is going to grow to 1 million NVIDIA chips, okay, which is the plan. Right now, it is going to be one of the large, when it's fully on the system. They're still building substations down in Southwest Memphis to get this thing on Memphis Light, Gas, and Water's grid fully. Like, that's what's happening right now. Like, if people wanted to take a drive, they could see that. All right. They have a lot of security, so just FYI. But the real thing going forward, though, is when you get to 1 million chips, it's pretty unlikely, from my reporting, that there is enough capacity on the Tennessee Valley Authority system for that right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so what would have to happen potentially is there has to maybe be, this is still probably hypothetical, and I want to phrase that, there probably has to be a new power plant of some kind to accommodate this thing's growth. And that is really significant. And who would be building that plant is up in the air. Who would own that plant is up in the air. And whether or not we're actually at like building a plant stage, I'm not saying we are. I'm just saying like, in order to get this thing fully on the grid, it could potentially take a new power plant.
Hmm. You did also, and again, this was, you broke the story before the Greater Chamber luncheon, but then Ted Townsend, I gather you, the CEO, Chamber CEO Ted Townsend, in an interview told you that NVIDIA, Supermicrocomputer, and Dell, the way it's phrased in the story, could soon invest in Memphis manufacturing facilities. Now, that would mean more jobs, right? What's the likelihood that one would attach to could soon invest?
I would say, and my colleague Sophia is, you know, following up on this reporting, I would say it's possible, right? Let's put it at 50-50, right? Which is better than things usually are, right? Like, I really don't know. And even me saying 50-50, I don't think is that informed. It just is that there's some interest. And why there would be interest, right, is, and I think one of the companies has not commented yet to Sophia and others, and I don't want to get too far in front of her reporting on this, but like, I think what you're really talking about is like a very large customer of theirs is going to be here in Memphis, Tennessee, right? In XAI. And so these companies, it probably makes sense, just like it makes sense for, you know, companies to co-locate around Walmart in Bentonville, Arkansas. It maybe makes sense for them to co-locate here. I'm not saying at any type of scale, right? Like, we're not going to become Bentonville, Arkansas, just like pretty unlikely. But that's for a similar concept, right? Like that's what could happen here.
Well, it's certainly interesting that they're willing to talk about it, that Ted is openly willing to talk about it. So that's either blowing smoke or it's hopeful. And I'll hope it is hopeful. Okay, the other massive news that happened since we last spoke is the report from the Department of Justice, the results of their investigation, finding that the police department does discriminate in the way it enforces the law. And then we have separately the city of Memphis saying that it would not enter into a consent decree with the Department of Justice that would provide for monitoring of changes in the police department going forward. So I guess the question would be this. What do you make of the fact, why did the city, let's put it this way, why did the city not agree to a consent decree or enter into a consent decree with the Department of Justice?
Let's talk about, as we're talking about why the city isn't in a consent decree, like the DOJ report, you know, reveals what they argue are rampant civil rights abuses by the Memphis Police Department. That's the context we're talking about here. Like, people can read this report from the DOJ. Its contents, I've read them. They are troubling, and they will be troubling to read, and they're quite sad. So moving on from that, the city of Memphis believes that a consent decree would cost the city taxpayers too much money. That is the reason they have given in public, that it would cost the city taxpayers too much money to hire independent monitors, because when these consent decrees happen, what happens is essentially the police department is mandated by these agreements to hire certain people to pay for independent folks who are monitoring the department's practices. Okay. And for example, the city of Memphis has a consent decree right now. It's under a consent decree called the Kendrick consent decree, which it has an independent monitor, which reviews how the city of Memphis uses social media to monitor criminal activity and make sure that the city doesn't right now stockpile information about people's freedom of speech and freedom of association when it's not a legitimate criminal investigation. Okay. So like, what would happen here under a consent decree about monitoring how the city of Memphis conducts traffic stops, for example, which could be part of this because the report found that traffic stops are rampant and misused and often borderline illegal, if not illegal. Okay. Or how it, you know, disproportionately arrests Black Memphians. Okay. Those things would require even more staffing and even more independent monitors. Okay, which would be paid for by the city of Memphis, which means the taxpayer. So that is why the city of Memphis does not, at this point, want to enter into a consent decree with the Department of Justice.
It's interesting. The given the troubling nature of the report, as you point out, sad, really, nature of the report, the city says, hey, listen, but we still want to do a better job. But we won't do this thing that the Department of Justice deems necessary to get it done. How does one, how, and maybe this is a question you can't answer, how persuaded can one be about the sincerity of the city in ameliorating these serious problems if they're just say, yeah, we'll do it ourselves. Never mind. We don't need you.
You know, that's a question that was asked, I think, multiple times. During a news conference last week, I think folks in the media, local media, did a really good job asking the city of Memphis that. I think what I would say is I don't know. I can't answer at this time.
Right.
And I don't think
maybe there's no answer. Maybe it's an unfair question.
Time will tell,
yes.
Right?
Yeah, like, right.
Time will tell.
Here's the thing.
Right.
So normally, what would happen here is the Department of Justice could file a lawsuit against the city, right? But all of this is in the context of the Biden Justice Department departing and the Trump Justice Department coming in. Is there not a fair likelihood that nothing's going to come of this because the Trump Justice Department is not interested in consent decrees? It wasn't historically during the last 4 years.
The city of Memphis, I want to be clear, Memphis Mayor Paul Young, when I asked him this, you know, during an interview, and then when he was asked, you know, during a news conference, you know, how does that factor into this?
Yeah.
You know, he simply said our posture would be our posture. Okay. Regardless of who was in the White House. That's what he said. Okay.
Yeah.
At the same time, he can say that. Okay. And it may be true. I'm not doubting his veracity, but also the this transition, given the comments and like, let's be honest, we do not know what the person in the White House coming down to the AG, coming down to the Civil Rights Department, what is really going to happen. Okay. Like, let's be clear, but given the president-elect's comments about policing and about crime historically and the previous 4 years, it's certainly the city of Memphis certainly is in a better position to do what it is doing now than it would be if Vice President Kamala Harris had won the 2024 presidential election. Let's just say that.
Where can people read the report? If they obviously can read the reporting on this over at the Daily Memphian. If you want to actually read the report, where can people read the report?
They can read it at the Daily Memphian. They can read it at the Commercial Appeal. Lucas Fitton and Rick Markman have done a great job on the story. They can read it on the DOJ's website. I mean, literally just Google Memphis DOJ Civil Rights Report. You will find a PDF rather quickly. And I would encourage like people who are going to want to form opinions about this, go read it. And that I want to also be clear, like, as I sign off here, like, you know, Kristen Clark, the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, said during her news conference, right, that there are a lot of, you know, police officers doing really good and important work in the city, despite these findings, right? Like, the two things can be true. There can be good policing, and then there can also be instances and widespread maybe potential practices of civil rights abuses in the city of Memphis. Those two things can be true. And so I just want to say that, and people should go read the report for themselves.
Thanks, Sam. Appreciate it. You can follow him on Twitter or X at Sam Hardiman and read his stuff over at the Daily Memphian. I have one piece of advice when it comes to holiday shopping, and the piece of advice is go to Old Call. I really do. Like, it's a easy, because here's the thing. You want a gift that the person will love. And I can guarantee the person will love it. They'll open it. They'll love it when they open it. And then they will love it all year long when they put on that piece of clothing. They'll think of who gave it to them. They'll think you. The right piece of clothing brings joy to your life. Second, you want a great shopping experience. Like, in the end, shopping at O'Call in the holidays is the way it is meant to be. They've got the wrappers who are right there, the people doing the wrapping right there, impeccable free wrapping. Honestly, they do all their alterations right on site. The clothes are absolutely stunning. And the people, listen, they were there helping you last Christmas and the Christmas before and the Christmas before, and they'll be here next Christmas. The people are the secret sauce. It is a holiday shopping experience like you'll find nowhere else. It is O'Call. Got to take a break. Back in a moment. 92.9 FM ESPN. So I stopped by Robert Owen Jewelers the other day, and it was as joyous as I recall. I go to the one that's right across from Novel on Perkins Extended. Howie's there. And again, I remind you, you can see ads for all kinds of jewelry stores, whatever else. Robert Owen Jewelers has been here for 46 years. 46 years. They came, they've invested in the community, put their arms around the community, and they've been making people happy and helping them celebrate engagements, anniversaries, birthdays, congratulations, I love yous, for nearly 5 decades now. And it's because they make the shopping experience extraordinary. If you're getting engaged, I would urge you to start there. Just start there. Go to Robert Owen Jewelers and let them walk you through how you buy a stunning, stunning diamond ring, like Jeffrey did, like Connor did at Robert Irwin Jewelers. Among everything else, they've got the meant-to-be guarantee. They're so confident you will love your diamond engagement ring. They offer a 365-day, no-questions-asked return policy. Just yet another thing that separates Robert Irwin Jewelers from everybody else. It is Robert Irwin Jewelers, locations across the city of Memphis, or check them out online at rijewelers.com. Jeffrey, it seems like we're running out of time. What else coming up next on 92.9?
Jeff, here's what's coming up next on Jason and John. Coach Hurd will join them today. CJ Hurt will join Kevin Cerrito and myself on Jeffrey Wright and Company. Cobb will be with Gabe, or beg your pardon, on the Gabe Kuhn Show with, of course, Connor and George.
Thanks for listening, buddy. We will be back tomorrow with Right and Right Trivia and Grizz tickets. For now, our work is done.